Hello, welcome to PSR People Speaking Rail. We are those people. I'm Mike Bowden-Bistel, I'm the head of intermodal solutions here at FreightWaves, which is a media-supported data company. I'm joined by, as always, by my colleague Joanna Marsh, who does the editorial writing for FreightWaves on the rail industry. Joanna, you wrote up a few articles this week, but I think the one that we should probably focus on is the one you did last Friday, Freight Rail Stakeholders Lay Out Their Challenges Before Congress. I think it's the one that's going to be most related to our guest today, which is Chris John, who is American Chemistry Council President and CEO. So this is a picture of your article there, a nice picture of, looks like a Union Pacific train on a bridge. Any idea what body of water that is?
Ooh, you know, I don't know, but, you know, our photographer, staff photographer, Jim Allen took that, and he's based in Texas. So, well, obviously, Union Pacific. So somewhere around Texas, maybe, if not sort of in a border area. There's a description. I will follow up maybe next, you know, sometime in a later episode, which body of water it is. But I think there's actually a description that he has, which I didn't put it in.
Yeah, it does look like the Gulf Coast. Like, it looks like there's something offshore there with some kind of drilling rig or something. But anyway, so what did you take away from that hearing before Congress?
Yeah. So on one hand, I don't think there was anything particularly new that was mentioned in the hearing in terms of like what major issues various stakeholders are looking at. I think probably the main thing, though, is that, you know, this is kind of I feel like it's the first congressional hearing where that featured several stakeholders within the industry, but also where it wasn't necessarily rail safety as being the number one priority. So, you know, there was also, some talk about rail service and some other sort of operational issues, such as, you know, whether there should be a limit on train lengths. Of course, the train crew size issue, which is kind of related again to rail safety. So it was interesting in the sense that it was still rail safety related, but still kind of touched on a broader range of issues, and that's kind of I feel like that's kind of where things are kind of heading in terms of public officials talking about rail stuff. So
yeah, I mean, certainly there's plenty of issues outside of rail safety, and it's worth mentioning the rail is a safe way to move any kind of bulk products on the surface of the earth. I think maybe the perception is that railroads are less safe than they actually are, given all that's happened this year. You had an interesting quote in there from Chuck Baker, CEO of the American Short Line Railroad Association. He suggests that we should hire back retirees and allow them to keep their retirement benefits. Sounds like it's not a bad idea. Maybe not a long-term solution to the labor issue, but an interesting idea.
Yeah, that was a little different. So it's nice to, you know, it's nice to have like little tidbits of that. Because for better or for worse, a lot of the public discussion is kind of and it was repetitive, but just you kind of know what to expect, so it's nice to have a little little detail like that related to labor.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one before. It's an interesting concept. So with that, I encourage everyone to go check out that article and then the other articles that you have up on the site. It's a few every week. Good way to stay informed on the rail industry. And, with that, I want to allow enough time for our guest. Our guest today is Chris John. He's president and CEO of the American Chemistry Council. That's a company or organization that, I'll let him explain it, but it's an advocacy group for, chemical companies, a lot of which are the big shippers on the freight rail industry. And, a lot of those companies really rely on the railroad industry to get their products to market because they're in such bulk quantities, really not terribly modally competitive. And as worth mentioning, we have a sonar chart on chemical carloads. It shows over the past several years, if we can get that up, which it's shown that a chemical carloads has been one of the growth areas in freight rail transportation. Part of that's related to The base feedstock, a lot of the chemicals have natural gas as a base feedstock. U.S. has a competitive advantage in that area. So promises to be sort of a growth area for the time to come. Chris, thank you for joining us on People Speaking Rail.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you give us just a little bit of an overview of the American Chemistry Council for those that are not familiar and how that's related to rail transportation.
Sure, absolutely. So our members are the leading companies in the business of chemistry. And those are large, as you said, large publicly traded corporations, global corporations, down to your small businesses and everything in between. And these folks are the scientists and engineers who make modern life possible and make the world healthier, safer, more sustainable, and more productive. So everything that our members make goes into the manufacturing supply chain. So that's everything for electric vehicle batteries or solar panels to chips and semiconductors. And so we represent their interests in the public policy space, whether it's here in Washington, D.C., internationally, or at the state and local level.
And you presented at the hearing that Joanna was describing there, the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee. What was your message?
Our message there was, you know, as you said, it was about supply chain issues and the fact that our members continue to have transportation challenges and problems, and our survey data shows that. And so while the pandemic is officially over, the challenges that we had throughout the pandemic are not over. And so specific to what you're talking about here, we still have rail challenges that need to be fixed. And we have structural problems with getting the service that our members deserve. And so we were advocating for both Congress and the STB to take some action that would help improve rail service for our members going forward.
On that point, I mean, what type of service issues, you know, are you seeing maybe more specifically? I mean, have you seen things like railroads cut from service from 5 days to 3 days, or just a congestion in certain areas, or just any more detail?
Sure. Happy to share that with you. So interestingly enough, while we have seen improvement in other modes of transportation and getting closer to pre-pandemic levels of service, we are challenged to get that same level of improvement on the rail side. So for example, 30% of our members saw service get even worse in the second half of last year rather than getting better. And we still have 3/4 of our members who say that rail service is not back to where it was in, compared to pre-pandemic levels. So we've had challenges with embargoes, for example. And I know you all have talked about that in the past. And so whether it's a certain railroad going from 5 embargoes in 2017 to over 1,000 last year, or another railroad that embargoed the entire state of California, which by itself is the 5th largest economy in the world. And so while that's only one embargo, there's a huge impact, particularly when that state has the biggest ports in the country as well. And so our industry, chemical and plastics industry, is winning on a global level, and we're a massive exporter and we have a big trade surplus. And so that impacts manufacturing jobs, both here in the United States, but also the prosperity all across the globe. So we've had significant challenges with rail over the past few years.
Yeah, certainly critical for the U.S. economy to have, your industry, performing well, having the transportation infrastructure it needs. The railroads, sort of blame the labor situation for a lot of these service issues. Is that your perception as well, or do you attribute it more to changes in operating procedures, trying to run trains too long, et cetera?
Yeah, so somebody a lot smarter than I called precision scheduled railroading, doing less with less. And so I think that's been a long-term challenge, I think, for the railroads and certainly for our members. I could tell you, what the impact on us has been. And so whether it's cutting staff, eliminating switch yards, slashing customer service resources, I mean, a lot of times it's really hard for our members to get a live body on the phone who can do something to help them. And it really, to us, indicates the lack of competitive service that our members receive. 3/4 of our members are captive shippers, which, as you know, means they only have one choice of railroad. And so we're looking as much as we can from to the STB and Congress to do things that would provide competition in rail service as required under the Staggers Act. And it's our hope that that would drive better service from railroads. So there's a lot there. I'm happy to unpack all of that for you.
Yeah, I think that makes, I think the next sort of logical thing is you're looking to the STB for some help. Now they finally have this CPKC deal behind it. Now that's been approved. That's probably been taking a lot of their resources, maybe all their resources. You know, what would you like to see them, focus in on now?
So you're right. It's a small agency with limited resources. And so, one of the things we want to do is make sure that Congress gives them the resources they need to perform their regulatory function. But specific to what we'd like to see them do is we'd like to see them act on the reciprocal switching proposal that's been pending there for 7 years. And so we'd like for them to move forward. As I said, rail industry is not competitive in the rates that our members receive over the past 15 years are reflective of that. So you look at a study that we did from 2004 to 2019, competitive service rates increased 24%. Non-competitive rates increased 230%. So again, it's our feeling that is a reciprocal switching can have some of the benefits that it has already had in Canada, where they've had that in place for a century, with the two major railroads up there are thriving. You mentioned the merger. They have the opportunity to compete to expand their footprint here in the United States. And so, again, we think that more competition among railroads is not only good for us and shipper interest, but to be really direct about it, we think it's in the railroads' interest. So their market share as a percentage of overall the transportation pie has declined over the past few years. And it's our feeling that more competition will cause them to have to invest and earn our business going forward, and that there are actually growth opportunities for them. So our industry is growing. We have made huge investments over the past decade and plan to going forward. So we already ship over 2 million carloads a year, and we expect that that will increase over the next decade by at least 120,000 carloads going forward as we have more capacity come online in the United States. So we would like to give more business to the railroads going forward. So we're a growth opportunity for them, but it's only if they earn that business. And we think it's through competition that'll make that happen.
Okay. I was kind of curious, would you have a sense of maybe what percentage of chemical freight you might consider to be captive to one railroad, or just to get a sense of how important reciprocal switching is for your membership?
Yeah. So about 3/4 of our member facilities are captive facilities. So we've only got 25% that has access to more than one railroad. I'll give you an example. We've got a member in the Southeast region, Mid-Atlantic Southeast region. And so because the chemical industry is globally competitive, and our chief competition, for example, comes from the Chinese. And Chinese imports coming into ocean ports in the Southeast region of the United States have access, because of those ports, to multiple railroads. But we have domestic production here that competes with that, that it only has access to one railroad, so therefore has poorer service and much higher rates. So we're actually, this is having the unintended consequence of creating more business for Chinese companies versus American companies. So that's just one small example of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Well, I guess, if you don't mind, if we kind of switch over to rail service, and I know that you've mentioned, that you've supported having railroads meet minimum service standards. I guess for you, how would you define good service? And what do you think those standards should be? And I guess I know that some shippers have mentioned sort of the first mile, last mile piece. If you could sort of talk about that as well, if that is one of the standards that you're looking at.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So I'll take the second question first. In terms of what we need is what we like for the STB to have is meaningful data on first mile, last mile service. as we see where that's where a lot of the issues are. And there isn't a lot of transparency for either us as a customer or the government to see what's actually happening, and for the government to be able to have information that is actionable in a quick enough time to make a difference. It's not enough to have information, you know, months in the rearview mirror that you can't do anything about. So we'd really like to have that information in place so that the only place, because there's no competition, the only place we can go is to the STB for redress. And they need to have the information available to them as quickly as possible to address service issues. So that's number one. And then in terms of service standards, you know, so the common carrier obligation right now is not, you know, well defined. And there was some conversation between STB Chair Overman and the committee last year about that. And the chair indicated he would be open to talking to Congress to making some of that more clear. But I think what most people don't understand, and even folks on the Hill don't understand, is, you know, in the contracts that we have with the railroads, unlike any other service we contract for, like we outsource janitorial services at a member facility and the floors are not swept, then the, you know, the service doesn't get paid. That's not how it works in the railroads. And so what we would like to have is some minimum service standards in those contracts so that they're more equitable. Again, because there's a monopoly service, our members are treated as such and don't really have ability to go across the street. You know, if you don't like your iPhone, you can go across the street and get yourself an Android. We don't have that ability to do that. And so we need some minimum service standards in those contracts so we have the ability to address problems when things go wrong. And unfortunately, all too often, things go wrong.
Yeah, that's makes a lot of sense. Fortunately, I was able to make it back here. I guess another question is, you know, is this on accessorials? I mean, that's been something that's been contentious between shippers and railroads. And you make a good point about how just the rail cars in the chemical industry owned mostly by either your members or they lease them from GATX or somebody. Can you talk about a little bit of how you'd like to see that the accessorial issue be more balanced between shippers and railroads?
Yeah, I think, you know, quite simply, it just needs to be a two-way street. So, you know, when the Staggers Act passed, 43 years ago, it was a completely different world. And we've got a regulatory system that has and a contract system that has not adapted to the new reality. And so if we're the ones delaying progress, then there's already a system in place to be held accountable for that. And if the railroads are the ones delaying or causing problems with the fluidity of the system, and getting our products to where they need to be, both inputs and outputs, then there ought to be some redress mechanisms for our members to access. And that we think, again, will give railroads an incentive, a financial incentive, to make sure that things move as smoothly as possible. So it's quite simply a fairness issue and a two-way street. And again, we want to give more business to the railroads, and we want to be able to hold them accountable when things go wrong.
Yeah, you should not be the only one who faces a potential penalty, if they,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really, you know, we learned these concepts in kindergarten, right? It's just, you know, everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten. So it's a simple fairness concept.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also about some of the rail safety, Rail Safety Act, and there's other piece of legislation coming out. And just, you know, what do you think is ultimately going to change there, if anything? I mean, you think there's going to be, you know, different standards for tank cars or rail cars in general? Just any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it's hard to forecast exactly where we end up since we have so many steps in the process to go. And we really have taken the first step here, right? Is we've got a bipartisan bill out of the committee, which we have supported. And we think they are taking a good first step with that legislation that can continue to be improved throughout the Senate and House process, and we hope that they could get something done on a bipartisan basis going forward. Look, we know that rail is by far the safest way to ship over land. We want to give more business to the railroads. And even though it's very safe now, we'd like to see it made safer. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about, as you said, tank car standards and the timing to do that. we are supportive of moving from 111 tank cars, for example, to 117 tank cars when we are able to do so. The data we've got from the manufacturers indicates, you know, the earliest you could do that is the middle of 2028, but we are willing to move ahead as quickly as possible as supply allows. And so I think, you know, that we'd expect that something along those lines would be in a final law if it got to that stage. And, you know, we will continue to be a constructive part of this process as it moves forward.
Are there any elements that you can think of, like within the bill as it currently exists? Of course, with the with the caveat that things might change, that you appreciate having within the bill, or are there is there anything that you would like to see, perhaps, if not removed, just not included in the bill, going forward?
Yeah, so they we appreciate both Chairman Cantwell and Senator Vance. We've worked closely with their staff, and we had raised a number of concerns in the past, and they addressed most of those issues. And so we think it's taken a good first step, and from the original draft to what came out of committee, we anticipate that we would continue to make progress going forward. I think we need to make sure that rail safety overall gets addressed. There's a lot of attention to hazardous materials transportation, and appropriately so. But again, I think when you see the number of derailments at 1,000, right? And that's, three a day, basically. And I think there's been two just in the last 24 hours. I saw Senator Brown from Ohio tweet about that. So I think fundamentally making sure that we reduce the number of derailments, and we're very, we at ACC, our members, as you might expect, the business of chemistry is very focused on science. So we're science-driven, risk-driven, data-driven. And I think as we go forward, let's look at those factors that lead to derailments, and let's have a risk-based approach to addressing that. I think that's the appropriate approach. There's a lot of attention to issues, but I think if we follow the data and follow the science, that's what we really ought to dedicate our resources and our thoughts on this issue.
That actually sounds similar to what I hear from the railroads as well, in terms of the data-driven aspect.
Yeah, and I would say on this issue that safety is the top priority for us and for the railroads. Again, it's the safest mode there is, and you guys know this. If you move from tank cars to tank trucks, you put four trucks on the road, right? So there are driver shortage issues, there are congestion issues. So, and we have infrastructure issues on our side where we are set up to ship through bulk transportation. We are set up to ship by rail. So we don't want to move to truck if we don't have to, because again, rail's safer and we're set up that way. But I think we ought to, again, our industry is very science-driven, risk-driven. And so that makes a lot of sense to us in this situation as well.
On that topic of modal competitiveness, you guys support the Ship It Act, which I guess would increase the gross vehicle weight. So potentially that would give you a little bit more, a better option on the highway when you needed it. What's the status of that, and any other thoughts on the Ship It Act?
Yeah. So, we're, as you said, supportive of the Ship It Act. We hope that it will move forward. And again, it's got bipartisan support, and it's our hope that that can move forward in this Congress. I know that there's in House next week, the T&I committee is marking up a supply chain bill. I don't know if this is something that can catch a ride on that or not, but I think as we look at this supply chain and the centrality of our industry to all of manufacturing, so what we make goes into the entire manufacturing supply chain. Everything that is manufactured starts with us. And so if we have problems, that ripples throughout the supply chain. It drives shortages. It drives inflation. And so it's our hope that we can make all modes of transportation, and we use all of them, as efficient as possible. And, by adding weight, interestingly enough, if you add that extra axle to the truck, you actually are spreading that weight on that extra axle. It's actually better for the roadways rather than, you'd think, and you would just think, hey, we're putting more rate, that's a weight, that's bad for the roads. It's actually not the case. So look, if we're going to achieve what we want to achieve in this country, the Biden administration has ambitious goals on the green economy, on manufacturing here in the United States, then we're going to have to be more efficient as a country, more efficient as a supply chain to make that happen.
It's an interesting nuance on the added extra axle. I didn't know that, but really interesting stuff there. That's really all the time that we have, but thanks so much for joining us today on PSR and how can people get in touch with the ACC if they would like to.
So you can go to AmericanChemistry.com and you can find us on all the various social media outlets as well. And I just say, look, leave you with a closing message. If we want to make more here in the United States of America, we need to move more chemistry. And that's what we're looking to do. So thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Great. Well, thank you. Hope everyone has a great day.
Yeah, thank you.